Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Word down your way. Testing 2-2.
Well, we're so looking forward to this. The co-writer of Mrs. Merton, Coogan's Run and Royal Family, and the producer of Gavin and Stacey and Red Dwarf and Philomena and other great works, talking about his first encounters with live entertainment. It's Henry Normal. Henry, very nice to see you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for being inviting me. That's lovely.
Not at all. And we'll talk about your tour that you're doing very, very shortly. But first of all, I wanted to go back to your earliest memories of first encounters, you know, with live entertainment. What was the first band you saw? Can you remember?
First band I saw was, not many people will remember this, Juicy Lucy.
Oh, oh Lord, yes.
Yeah.
With that disgraceful album sleeve with the grapes.
Yeah. They had one single, I think, which was Who Do You Love?
Who Do You Love?
Yeah.
And the steel player was, sorry, I'm going to get boring here, was called Glenn Fernando Campbell.
Oh, right.
And he'd been a former member of a Californian psychedelic group called The Misunderstood that John Peel was very keen on. So right. Juicy Lucy always got a bit of a head.
They were on
it. You don't normally get this kind of response when you mention Juicy Lucy. You make people go, who the hell are you talking about? And here we are talking about, you know, the bass player, where it was.
Yeah, no. Not many people remember them. Yeah, it was at the Boat Club in Nottingham, and I was 17.
Oh, so, oh yeah,
1973, and
Led Zeppelin played once.
The Boat Club had had such luminaries as Led Zeppelin, even though you could only get about 120 in if at a push, really.
But
I was taking a chance, really. I wasn't really a big fan of Juicy Lucy, but I just thought I went with my sister, who was 19, and the dark, dank atmosphere of it all, and you know, the beer and the mood of it all, because they're a little bit frightening, Juicy Lucy, at times, for a 17-year-old. I loved it. I was drawn to it.
Right. Had you been to anything before that? Had you been to any kind of
cantos
or comedy shows or any of those kind of memories as a child?
I've been to the cinema, of course. I remember I went to see, Elp with the Beatles. But I had actually, before then, at the age of 14, I ran a disco for old age pensioners. The local old age pensioner club. And we'd play, because they were quite old, we'd play March of the Mods on 33 instead of 45. Give them a fighting chance.
Oh, yes. March of the Mods, of course, co-written by Roy Carr. He used to work for the NME.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Written between
him
and his dad.
Yes.
He used to make a few quid.
I wish, it were camcorders at the time, weren't it? I wish it had camcordered it.
Yes.
But there you go. And I did actually see the first ever comedian came at Christmas to that club. And I remember talking to him beforehand, and he was very serious. Now, I thought, he can't be a comedian. He's very serious. He's not making a joke at all. And then he went off, and he changed it into a school uniform. Kid's school uniform, and he came on. I always remember his first joke. He came on, he went, "Oh, me dad, my mum says, what do you want for Christmas?" And I said, "I want something to wear and something to play with." And she gave me these shorts with holes in the pockets.
Oh, that's very end of the pier, isn't it?
All the pensioners loved it. And I thought, he's obviously saving the funny stuff for this.
Yeah.
Very good. Very good. When did you first perform yourself on stage?
Oh, I'd be about 19. And I was working as an insurance broker, which is one of the reasons why I chose the name Henry Normal. I used to wear a suit every day as an insurance broker, and I'd actually seen by that time. I'd seen my first ever poet, which was Roger McGough.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, right.
And I saw him at Nottingham Playhouse on a dinner time. I'd sneaked off from work at dinner time to watch him, and he'd read Summer with Monica. I don't know whether you know that poem. A lovely group of poems about spending the whole of summer with your girlfriend.
Right.
And of course, you can imagine at 19, I was besotted with this idea. And I thought, well, I can read off a bit of paper. how hard's that? So I wrote some stuff and I got up, and I think I only did about three poems. And I think I got 15 quid. So that was what.
Were they comic, or were they you expressing yourself?
They were funny ones.
Can you remember the titles of any of them?
There was one. Yes, there was one about the poem with no name. So it was. I might be able to remember it. In the movies, he rode off into the sunset. But the next day, I saw him shopping in Tesco's. The checkout woman gave him a bad time, and he never even shot her once, which only goes to prove Tesco's isn't like real life at all.
And
very, 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 very Roger McGoughish.
It is, just leaves it hanging there, doesn't it?
I'm very interested in this. So, when are we talking about here? When you went to see Roger McGough when you were 19?
When I was 19.
When's that?
When's that? So I was born in 56. So that'll be 75.
Okay. No, because it's really interesting. The whole. You know, I'm older than you, but, you know, the influence of the Liverpool poets and that little Penguin book, was it Penguin, I think, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Mersey Sound and so forth was just massive, wasn't it, for years. And so for people like you successfully and me unsuccessfully, who could never master a guitar or anything,
yeah.
Writing poems was a way to impress young women, wasn't it, basically?
Oh, yeah. And I got very little else going for me. As you say, my dad played the drums in a jazz band.
Oh, right.
And my brother, he used to be in various duos. One of them was called the No Can Duo. That
was quite very nice. Good.
And he played guitar, but I got no talent whatsoever. I have actually sang on a Packet of Three, which was a television programme I did, to 3.4 million viewers, but luckily it was a comedy song. But in lieu of being a rock star, yes, it did seem at the time that reading poems off a bit of paper was the next best thing. And
but also carrying around a battered copy of that Liverpool poet's book was an indication to girls that you were deep and sensitive.
Sensitive, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. There was a lovely thing as well. I was a big Spy Milligan fan as well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I remember Small Dreams of a Scorpion came out around that time. And because he was so funny in all his other books and TV and radio and everything, the fact that he was so tender impressed me. And I've ever since, I've been trying to get that balance between being laugh out loud funny, but also, to touch people, and be emotional with what you might call a greater truth. And I think, strangely enough, I think Spike Milligan probably did it in a starker sense than the Liverpool poets.
No, I'm sure.
And of course, there was Adrian Mitchell around at the time. He was doing similar stuff.
Yeah, he was.
But really,
there weren't that many people. Yeah, there weren't that many people in the 70s. I mean, I suppose John Cooper Clarke was one of them. Did you ever get to see him in the early days?
I've played with John Cooper Clarke many times, yes. I remember I had to drive him to Retford one day. I was living in Manchester, and I went to pick him up, and I thought, I'll pick him up about 3 o'clock. That should do it. Got around at 3 o'clock. He was still in bed.
Right.
He got up, and for breakfast he had an egg custard.
Oh, no.
And he lived exactly where you'd expect him to live, next to a graveyard. And I thought, he's living
like he just emerged from it.
Yeah, that's right. I like the idea that you talk about, I played with John Cooper Clarke. So yeah. That's the way you talk about it. You say, it's a gig, I play.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. And you are playing, aren't you? You're having a bit of fun.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
The old idea of going on stage, it's a strange thing to do, isn't it? I mean, you are reading stuff that you've already done, or telling jokes that you've made up. So it is like a play in a sense. You hope to hone in on some truths, and you hope to be as genuine as possible. But you're not ad libbing an hour.
No, sure. But you presumably. You don't want to be booked on the comedy circuit, do you?
No.
That's the worst thing in the world.
No, I have done those.
No, sure.
And to me, it's funny enough, I was talking to Steve Coogan about this a while back, and we were saying that the great thing about comedy is it's like sugar and salt. It makes things taste better. But if you want to eat sugar or salt purely on its own, it's better if it's with something. So for me, with being with the poetry, it sort of makes it all worthwhile. But if I just had to do comedy, I'd like to think in all the TV and films that I was involved in that there was an element beyond the comedy.
Right. No, of course. So this tour that you're doing soon. What kind of venues are you doing, and how? What kind of people come?
Well, we've done 9 at the moment, so
right.
we're Monmouth is the next one. They're sold out,
right?
Great, and we're talking sort of 500 to 900 seaters.
Very good.
Prime Bilston is on with me. We do an hour each, and it's stories, jokes, and poems. And it is a lot of fun, and Brian's a lot of fun. I do all the driving, and he does most of the talking, and we have a laugh between the gigs, which is great.
Right. So, what sort of people come?
It's mainly people of an experienced vintage. People who appreciate, a bit of layered entertainment. So I would say if a 20-year-old come, they'd bring the average down quite a lot. It's mainly over 40s. We're 45 the over 40s, I think was the old advert, wasn't it?
Oh, great.
That was Philosan. Philosan 45 is the over 40s.
I should change my name, shouldn't I, to Phil?
Yeah. Phil O'Sam. There's a future in that. So tell me, how do you structure? Like you say, you're not just going out there and saying the first thing that comes off the top of your head. Do you just go on, carry on? Do you?
Yeah, no,
how structured is it? Go on.
In terms of structured, well, it's like any conversation. It's like any play that you'd see or film or everything. You want bits that are upbeat and excited, or even a band. If you think of bands, they've got the big loud numbers, yeah. Got the gentle numbers, and you know, you lay it out very much as a band would lay out a set, and you sort of juxtapose so that I like to call it a salad rather than a soup.
Right.
Yeah.
So that you get lots of different flavors.
Do you all start with the same things and finish with the same things?
No. I'm trying very much, because I have a radio show on Radio 4. I try all the time to bring in new things so that I can put them into the next radio show. And I've done 11 now, so that's they're half an hour each. So that's 5.5 hours worth of
material. Right.
So I'm on my next half hour's worth of material, so it changes all the time, and it can change if you see us at the beginning of the tour. It'll be quite different at the end of the tour.
Yeah. So is that you doing? You're individually reading poems, and also this kind of section in the middle with the comedy between the two of you.
Yeah, and very often the poem has come out of an incident. So it's born out of it. So you can talk about the incident, very often they're incidents that are funny in themselves, or they're tragic in themselves.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot maybe your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So they lend themselves to nice little stories. So it's those, and as you're performing them, lines come to you, and as with conversation, things will crop up. So it develops. It's quite nice, really. I mean, even when you're writing a poem, you can be starting to write a poem, you've no idea how it ends.
Yeah,
it's a little adventure, which is nice.
Go on, Dan.
Do you ever write, perform anything that you say, I've just written this afternoon, kind of thing?
Oh yeah, very much so. Yeah, and the thing really is to have the courage to do things that you're not sure about. And what I find is the things that you'll worry about the most are the things that go down the best.
Yes.
And, for anything where, it's touched you, because poems make me cry, you'll find that other people are not too dissimilar, and they'll be able to latch into it as well. And things that hopefully I find funny or other people find funny. So you've got to trust your instincts. And of course I've done, at least 1,000 gigs. So, it's like radio, presenting. Mm. You get a knack to it.
Right. And do you talk about your kind of personal background in television and comedy and so forth?
I do sometimes, yes, and little stories about working with Caroline Hearn and Steve Coogan and lots of other people that I've worked with over the years, and little incidents that that can come up. I try not to do too much of that because you can be like a tribute band to yourself if you're not careful.
Yeah, yeah.
So I try to, you know, if it's a new thing that I've remembered, then I'll do that. Because there's people that do see me again and again, and you know, I don't want them going, I remember laughing at that in 1984.
You've told that story before.
Well, some people do like that, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
I interviewed Clive James, and he was talking about doing literary festivals. And I said, what do you do? He said, well, I talk about poetry and I talk about my new book, and then I tell the story of the Dunny Man. And the Dunny Man, with familiar to anybody who remembers reading Clive James' unreliable memoirs all those years ago, is just a funny story about something that happened as a child in Australia. He was still telling the story.
Yeah.
50, 60 years later, and people still wanted to hear it again and again.
He regarded it like a hit single. It's the one thing I can't get off stage without having done The Dunny Man, because people just love
happy.
It. Yeah. They love it.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. And, you know, there's bands that I would go and see and artists that I would go and see, and if they didn't do one or two of my favourites, I'd be a bit upset. So we do occasionally put in, you know, sort of greatest hits. It's always difficult to know what your greatest hits are. You're not always the decider.
No, that's true.
But you can imagine why some of these bands, though, that break up. You imagine, like, Free, I remember, broke up and became Bad Company, didn't they? And I was thinking, he's just sick of singing All Right Now, isn't he?
I think it was getting a lot
more of the other members of the band.
Exactly. Bad Company with you.
Can I ask about Royal Family just quickly? I mean, there must be certain things that you worked on that you're very proud of. I mean, why do you think that was such a big success?
I think it's a big success because we were as honest as possible in portraying working class life as it is. And I don't think it had ever been done before. People had edged to it in various plays and you know, things like Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, you know, and some of those 60s kitchen sink dramas. But certainly as a sitcom, Till Death Us Do Part had done a version of it, but nobody had said, right, well, we're going to really sort of look at it head on. And of course, what we did was we took half an hour of the life of a family and we did it in real time.
Yeah.
And we did it on film, close in. You know, they were doing stuff on film at that time.
Yeah.
Because we did that, you were there in the room with them. And a lot of those lines in the first series were lines that our parents and our friends had actually said.
Yes.
Well, when we sat down to write it, Caroline just said, we're going to write this story of a family. And I got no idea who were in the family. And she got no idea who were in the family, really, apart from the mum and dad and her. And we just said, right, what does your mum and dad say? And that's and we actually wrote the first episode in 2 hours. It just fell out of us in 2 hours. Mm. And it was written as a stream of consciousness, me, Caroline and Craig. And it just and I used to write it all down, and then I'd go and type it up and just change it around a little bit, make sure it all worked. That script never changed to that's what you see on the television, and it took 2 years from writing it to get it on the television. Because the bosses didn't quite understand that was reality, you know, because they weren't working class and they weren't northern. So, you know, they'd say, can they be friendlier? So what do you mean? They all love each other, but it's not Dallas. They're not going to say, you know, I love you, son. That's not how it works in the North. You insult people.
Insult people to express affection, don't you?
That's right. You know, we had a read through and then we did a version of it that was on multi-camera as opposed to single camera, and that looked a bit too bland. So then we did the single camera, and it just came out. Luckily, it came out right.
The thing I found amazing is looking back on it, you think that was once on television, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And And do you think that if anybody had that kind of idea now, it wouldn't be on television? It would, I don't know, be on...
We were in a good position because we'd done three series of the Mrs. Merton show and that had gone down really well. So people were anticipating what Caroline did next. And she was always quite stubborn, Caroline. And she said, this is what I'm doing. Take it or leave it. So if the B-band took it, ITV would have. It sort of forced their hand a bit. And I don't think they knew quite what they were getting. I remember the Guardian review for the first episode said it was written by three middle-class people.
All right.
Now, I don't think Caroline or Craig or myself, if we opened his mouth, is going to pass for middle-class. They obviously didn't get it. I mean, now, if you ask anybody at the Guardian, we loved it from the off. But
no. Dave's point, I think, is true that you can't imagine anyone commissioning anything that slow anymore, actually. And something that takes getting used to, you know, it's everything's so much faster and more edited.
It is, and so I think it was obvious time, but it was partly a reaction to the fact that you'd had all those Terry and June episodes, and there was a lot of sitcoms around the time where everything was quite farcical, and you'd have things like, you go, oh, the vicar's come in and my trousers are down, what shall I do? Well, pull your trousers up and say hello to the vicar. There's not a problem. And so because it was in that era, this was such a new thing that, it sort of struck home. Obviously, having done it now, anybody else that tries to do it, and of course The Office and lots of other great programmes around the time, you're going to be judged against those programmes. And, for a new programme, it's difficult. I would say in terms of legacy, Gavin and Stacey happened because the Royal Family happened.
Right. That's interesting.
And there was trusted that could work. And I loved recently Derry Girls.
Yes, fantastic.
It's a great portrayal of...
No, it's true. So even that's a few years ago, isn't it, now? I struggle to think what it is right now that's creating that kind of buzz.
I don't know. There's nothing that I see on television that you could champion in that way. But it'll come, I'm sure.
Right.
What have been your particular favourites in the past? I mean, things that you didn't work on. I mean, the Frasier Friends, those ideas.
I like an Australian show called Mr. In Between. I don't know whether you've seen it.
Oh, yes, I've seen
it. No, I haven't, no.
The Hitman.
I laughed out loud and I cried. Australians do working class very well. They do matter.
They do.
Far better than the Americans. And as you say, it's a hitman. But it's not a hitman like like you get in the movies. It's like a hitman that's coming round like the milkman had come round.
Yeah.
It's very, very downbeat, and he's got a daughter and he's got a brother with a serious condition and a dad that he doesn't speak to. And it's the old family thing, and your heart goes out to him and feels for this man trapped in this world. But it's incredibly funny because the main character has got a skewed view of life, and sometimes you find yourself reluctantly agreeing with him. And sometimes it's abhorrent.
Do you remember there was I thought of this when Mrs. Merton came out. There was an Australian comic called Norman Gunston.
Oh, I love Norman Gunston.
Absolutely amazing guy who was a kind of fictional interviewer, wasn't he? Like Mrs. Merton.
Oh, he was brilliant. He was brilliant. Always had a bit of.
He had himself shaving. He had always a bit of paper stuck on his face. There's a wonderful bit where Warren Beatty had arrived to tour of Australia or whatever. He was there at the airport, and he did the interview with him. Warren Beatty has no idea who this guy is, He says, Warren Beatty, you've been here for 3 minutes, had any luck with the ladies? And he goes, well, no, not really. And he turns to his other camera and goes, Warren Beatty. Like, it's just so wonderful.
He was great. I remember seeing him at an American base in Australia, and he was talking to the guard at the American base, and he said, let us in. He says, I can't, it's the American base. And you go, just 1 foot. Just put 1 foot in. He was edging himself in. He was very, I thought, I mean, I don't know what the time sequence is, but he looked like he was probably the first one to do that.
Yeah, well, that whole thing that Alan Partridge and, well, I suppose Dame Edna as well, first the interviewers who were fictional characters.
Yeah, yeah. And it was Dennis Pennis at one time, weren't they?
Yes.
But the thing about Norman Gunther, he had a certain geeky charm that he could get away with it. And you were always on his side. He never, you never felt he was being horrible. You always felt he was just being cheeky.
Yeah,
right. So, what's your next project beyond this?
Beyond a certain point, death. I've marked that in the calendar. Do you know, I'm loving doing the Radio 4 shows. So my next one is a normal. I theme them in loosely. Next one is a normal story. So I'm working towards that. So that'll be I think my 12th show, and I write the books. I don't really have any great ambition because I'm sort of retired in a way. So I'm just enjoying.
It's a pretty hectic schedule for retirement.
We're just saying before you came on, though, it's quite rare for people to be in your position to retire nowadays. Everybody else keeps going, don't they?
They do, but not everybody's got an autistic son, you see. So,
right, okay.
I have a son who's autistic. He's 25 now, and my wife Angela and I tag team as a lot of parents do to make sure he has a great life, which he does, and I enjoy that. I enjoy being with him. And so that takes up time. And the poetry really is a little bit of an adventure for me whilst I'm doing that.
Right. Well, you're halfway through the tour, you know, so the traditional sign-off, as we used to say on Whistle Test years ago, good luck with the tour. Come back and tell us about it.
Thank you. I will. That was great.
Word down your way. Testing 2-2.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.